This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code, where today's guest is David Starr. David is a software craftsman who specializes in agile software development. He hails from Boise, Idaho, and you probably already know his work through being a Microsoft MVP or a Pluralsight author, from working with Scrum.org or his blog at ElegantCode.com. What you might not know is he was the developer for the original NASCAR.com site.
You welcome, just did that.
David.
Well, thank you. Although that last little bit, the whole NASCAR theme, as you guys found out a few minutes ago, that NASCAR thing is the bane of my existence, because there's a NASCAR truck driver, can't even be a car driver, right? It's a truck driver named David Starr. And that's davidstarr.com, and I can't get the domain away from the guy, and so he's got all my Google juice.
Well, good news. Now he'll be associated with your appearance on this podcast, too, so you won't get any juice out of this.
Maybe we could get a Herding Code sticker on his truck, camper, car thing that he drives.
Oh, I will look into that.
Okay. Just as an aside, NASCAR truck racing with a camper top would be something I would watch.
With a turret.
With a turret. And a six-pack.
Anyway, that's actually just how it works.
So other than NASCAR.com, what have you been doing recently?
Well, Scott, to answer your incredibly broad and open-ended question, I have just spent 1 year working for Scrum.org and recently took the opportunity to change jobs. I'm going to go work with Peter Provost and some of the other guys in the Visual Studio teams at Microsoft as a senior PM here in the next month. In fact, we're moving next week.
Oh, wow.
From Boise to Redmond.
So basically, you have to drive just a couple hundred miles.
It is. It's about 500 miles, and we make the trip all the time because my wife's from there. But this will be fun because I learned that we've got temp housing, and we're going to be in a three-bedroom apartment with four kids, two dogs, a cat, two fish, two rats, and, I don't know, probably a bunch of fleas. It's going to be great.
Maybe more rats if you're lucky.
So what are you looking to do, or, you know, what specific areas?
Okay, so the reason this all came about is because I've been running into Peter Provost on, you know, at conferences and such for the last couple of years, and we've had really good ongoing discussions about how tooling should support people and good practices. And one of the big things we've talked about is how might one implement executable specification across the .NET stack in all that might mean in both tools and frameworks, et cetera, et cetera. And there's some pretty significant implications to how it might change the way we develop software. So I'm pretty excited about that. And that's a big component of the discussion that I've been having with Microsoft. And it's going to be part of this change, although I'm not there yet. I don't quite understand the full job and how it's going to work. You know, we'll see what happens over the next year.
Sure. So that matches up with what you've been doing over the years. And coming from Scrum.org, I'm just really curious, what's your current perspective on that, the whole world of Scrum right now?
You just went straight for the jugular, didn't you? I have to be somewhat grown up in this answer. There are a lot of people out there that are doing a lot of good work with Scrum still. I think that people who might listen to this show would consider Scrum to be old hock, old business, you know? I can tell you that there are a lot of companies out there that are still deriving benefits from just the most basic elements of agility and having those introduced to their companies. So I think Scrum.org, Scrum Alliance, and all the people that are involved in those sorts of organizations, they do good work. They're trying to improve the world, and in many cases, they're doing it. Scrum adoption is almost ubiquitous in software development. There was a survey that came out, I believe, in January or February of this year that indicated that of the people who are the organizations who report to be using agile software development of some kind or another, that 92% of them use Scrum.
Oh, wow.
That's an overwhelming statistic. So there's still good stuff being done out there with Scrum, but you know what? There's really not a lot of examples that I have found of organizations that have fully exploited empiricism and empirical process models so that they can make decisions based on evidence instead of hope. So that's what that's really all about. And companies tend to think that this Scrum stuff is a way to manage the daily checklist. You know, it's a way to manage the work through the system, force the water through the pipe. And that's really not the end game. If you talk to some of the agile executives that have changed the way their companies work and become more profitable by making decisions differently. So most companies won't get that. Most companies are just going to use this to manage the work on a few teams. And, you know, maybe that's okay for them.
So you're saying it's not getting outside of certain teams, certain departments, not getting outside of engineering to transform the company?
In most cases, it's not. And I'll tell you a very, trying to think about whether or not it's okay to use this name. I went and taught a class in Redwood City, California, in this really big database manufacturing company. And you know, there was some good discussion there about how we might be able to change the way teams do business, et cetera, et cetera. And we kept having the discussion. I would ask, well, what about that person's boss? And keep trying to climb the chain. And eventually I get up to somebody who, quite frankly, is a pretty mean chief executive. And what that means is that the company will reflect the culture of its leadership. And there's really not a big point in trying to institute organizational change like Scrum when you've got a controlling dictator at the helm of your organization. So that was one of the big moments in my career where I decided I need to get away from this methodology work. It's not going to help based on humans again. I just want to get back to tech for a while.
Yeah, that's cool. And so switching over into actually working on tooling, that'll be, I guess you're looking to have a little more immediate impact on people.
Well, I want to make stuff again. Yeah. You know? And I want to quit talking about making stuff and make stuff again. So it's been about a year since I've written real code and gotten some software to ship out of something. And I just need to do that. That's part of who I am. So I'm going to go back to that. And if what I can do is help make a set of tools that will help us get better at writing software in general and delivering it, then great, all the better. I've always thought there's kind of this hierarchy of badassery and developers, right? So you've got like language developers at the top. And then somewhere really near the bottom is, you know, my mom writing macros in Excel. And somewhere in the middle there, but near to the top, are the guys who write tools for other developers. And I'm really psyched to be part of that. I think that's going to just be amazing fun. And when your customers are developers, man, I think you're just living the dream.
True that. Hey, can I ask you a couple questions about some of your blog posts, recent blog posts?
Yeah, man.
One's about Subspec. Can you tell us a little bit about Subspec? It looks interesting.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting. I was really enamored of this little tool. So Subspec is, it looks a lot like MSpec. And if you've played with MSpec, you know that it has these types defined in it, context, and because, those sorts of things. Every single tool that I've found out there that supports some sort of behavior-driven model tries to force their taxonomy and language on you. So like with MSpec, I have to think in terms of context, because, assert. I've seen other tools that make me think in terms of arrange, act, assert. I've seen others that make me think in terms of given, when, then. So everybody's trying to push this syntax on me. Now with Subspec, the designers of that particular extension XUnit recognize that every single time we test something, we do the same three things over and over again, one, two, three. So what we do is we put a system up into some state, right? We spool up that context and get the system under test into some state. And then we poke it. That's the act or the when. And then we check something on it. That's the assertion piece. Well, what these guys realize is that, yes, we have to do those same three things over and over again, but we don't have to force the developers to use a language in expressing that. So the way they implemented this was with extension methods to strings. So what I do is I type, you know, I've got my little test, my fact in XUnit, and the first line in there is a string. And I say, open quote, type my sentence, close quote, dot, and then through that, I pass in an action, right? And this is what I want to happen at this place in my specification. Well, that can read any way I want. I could write a string that says, given there is no text in the search box. Or I could write a string that says, there's no, you know, there is no text in the search box. I could write a string that says anything. Mm-hmm. And then I say dot context, and then I write the code for my context. The reason I find this significant is, again, it recognizes the fact that there is a 1-2-3 punch type of taxonomy to the style, or the way of writing tests, but it doesn't make me talk that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be hugely important when we look at how these tools will evolve, because we don't have a definitive test, DSL or taxonomy. You know, Gherkin's great, but it doesn't cover every situation.
I was going to ask how you would compare it to Specflow, where you can basically type in a sentence, but then you have to go through a translation phase and implement steps and things like that.
You know, I'm not a big fan of model solutions in general, and that solution with Subspec definitely is one. It's a really good solution. I think it's a good step on our learning for these tools, but it is a model-based thing. And what that means is that I have synchronization issues. So if I open up a feature file, which is how that particular tool works, and write some text in it, given this, when this happens, then this should be the result, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll save it. Now, as you know, what happens is that kind of turns into a code file. It's actually a reasonable way to think about it would be like with an ASPX page, and you save that and you get an ASPX.cs file behind it. Same thing happens with Specflow. And the way that you attach that up to your code, very Ruby-like, is through regular expression and string matching, right? So there's these attributes that are in that code behind file that then match over to code that you write via attributes. And so if I write a sentence in one of those attributes, it'll match back to the feature file. And this kind of breaks when I want to allow my business folks, maybe the person who wrote the original spec, go into the feature file, change it, and they don't tell the developer, well, that's going to break the test. So there's this, or vice versa. And what we know is that tests evolve under the developer's hand, as they should. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, some original test was written by a quality assurance person or a BA or somebody who is studying this product, a developer will take that and massage it a little to change the wording to make it fit contextually. When we do that, if we break the association to the original feature file, it's just more work. So the solution's a good one. I find it to be a little bit fragile in the way that GUI testing is fragile.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. But overall, it's the best thing I think out there in the .NET stack to get started with executable specification, because it's very simple. It's very straightforward.
Cool. And trying to think of a way to smoothly transition between these questions, but another blog post you had was about the Software Professional Code of Ethics, and about how you at one point thought it might be worthwhile to try to create a code of ethics. And as of, I think, that post, you had kind of given up on that. What's your current thoughts there?
Well, I think that it would be nice if we had a profession. That's really what
agree.
That's what it came down to. Wouldn't it be great if we could stand in a circle and recognize that we are professionals, that we have a profession on our hands, and it happens to be called software development? That'd be great. And what are some of the things that are part of other professions? You know, you start looking around, and what you find is you have professional associations, which we have. Great. They tend to publish a code of ethics. One of the things that I did while working at Scrum.org with Ken Schwaber, we sat down and talked about this issue and came up with a proposal for an initial set of code of ethics that may be applicable to software developers. And I put it out there on my blog, Scott, just as a, hey, what does the world think about this? And there were some really good comments that came in on that post, as I recall, that led me into investigating other attempts that have already been made at this in the past. And it turns out that if you go to IEEE, they have a code of ethics that they purport to have. I don't know. It's supposed to relate to software development, I guess, in some way. But you start reading this thing, you know, it's just pages and pages and pages of legalese, and it's not interesting at all. So I wanted something that we could all just stand back and look at and say, yes, we can agree to these things. And the way I came up with my initial list is I sort of teased apart the Hippocratic Oath to see what physicians go through as a shared profession when they take the Hippocratic Oath. So do I think that overall a code of ethics would be helpful? I think what would be more helpful is an organization that could stand behind them, an organization made up of people who want to establish the profession of software development. And I don't know that that exists. So it was probably putting the cart before the horse, quite frankly.
I wonder about that too sometimes, but yeah, go ahead, John.
Well, I'm curious. So, I mean, a lot of the things we're talking about seem to kind of cross into different areas that I think of conceptually. Like, on the one hand, there's like Scrum, there's IEEE, there's people who are thinking about, you know, things like professional, I don't know, like code of ethics and that kind of thing. And then on the other side, I mean, some of the things like we were talking about earlier with executable specifications, and I don't know, just kind of in general, you know, like there's kind of like a there are other approaches to software development that are, you know, pretty rapid and kind of are saying, you know what, like, I don't know, like I think about the Ruby world or something, right? And they're not at all interested in IEEE's, you know, type professional code of ethics kind of things. I'm wondering, like, it seems like you're definitely bridging across a few different worlds there. I'm wondering about your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that IEEE is just irrelevant to today's software developers. And I don't think that an organization built around a software development methodology should be in any position of publishing a code of ethics either. So while Scrum.org was, you know, handy, a handy place to be in to think about a code of ethics, I don't think that an organization based on methodology should steward them. So that's why I go back to who should be the steward of a code of ethics that applies to our entire industry. And I don't think we have a good overarching answer to that, because there's no organization that we can all point to, whether I work in Java, Ruby, or .NET, or native C++, whatever. I can point at some org and say, yeah, I'm a part of that. I'm a part of all these other software developers in the world. We don't have that. Without that, I don't think there's any point in publishing a code of ethics.
Mm. We'd had a discussion like a couple of years ago about kind of like a board certifying software development. This following the same kind of process that doctors have to go through, where they go through and they have to take their review boards, and then every few years they have to provide so many continuing education credits to show that they're kind of keeping up with their profession. And so, you know, software and medicine are kind of far apart on the important to human life scale, but that was kind of the conclusion we'd come to, that who would run this? Because, you know, there's the Oracle certs, there's Microsoft certs, there's Scrum certification, there's all sorts of certs out there. And, you know, all of them are making money off of the certs. So it's in their best interest to A, keep coming out with certs, and B, make those certs easy enough to pass, but not so easy that it seems like a gimme.
Right. So here's the deal. Speaking as a guy who has written, I have written tests for Microsoft certification, and I have written tests for Scrum certification. So all those certifications that people talk about that are worthless, you know those? I've written all those tests. And here's what I can say at the end of all that. Any sort of certification offered by a tool vendor or a tool creator is worthless. Any sort of certification created by a methodology proponent is also worthless. That's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is some sort of overarching body that says this is what it means to be in the profession of software development, right? We're not talking about what method should I call with what parameters to affect this thing in the framework. That's not it.
Mm. Yeah, and that's kind of what we were discussing. It was, you know, so we've got all the vendor certs out there and professional organization, but they're either really specific to tool vendor framework stuff or to methodology or whatnot. And we were looking at kind of an overarching, you know, kind of, okay, if you're going to be a software developer, or I think we'd even discuss software architect as a title rather than a organizational goal. How would you certify, you know, software architect? Because, you know, are there other things that are common enough across that you could design like a legal bar? Say, okay, you got to pass the bar exam, or, you know, you got to pass your boards to become a board certified software architect. So even just aside from the fact that, yeah, you need someone to administer who was, you know, mostly impartial in terms of, or let's say agnostic in terms of vendors, tools, frameworks. just looking at software, how could you even certify, or, you know, how would you test for something? Because being a Ruby architect is different than being a Scala architect, is different than being a Java.NET architect, and so forth. And enterprise versus like Amazon, Heroku, web scale kind of engineering is different than, you know, mom and pop site versus internal site with total users.
So I get that. And looking at other professions that have instituted something like this, you don't have to just look at everybody likes to talk about medical and legal. Those are reasonable things to look at, but also there are the trades, right? So we can look at trade certification for things like electricians and plumbers. I'm sure, because I know K. Scott well enough, that he has beat this into your guys' heads and called it guilds, right? He's done that, yes?
He mostly just snores during our podcast. I regret.
Well, that's what you naturally end up with. And if you start tracing those trade organizations, they end up being unions. And so if you look at teacher certification, you mentioned these things like ongoing credits and reestablishing your credentials and renewing your certification. Teachers do that. Electricians do that. Plumbers do that. And it turns out that in the trade world, or if it's not legal and it's not medical, it's probably a union that did it. And we're not really, you know, that doesn't sound too attractive to me either. I'm not proposing that we need a software developer union. It's just that that's where these things tend to come from.
I think, you know, and maybe it's just that I don't know these other professions and plumbers, like there's different groups of plumbers that violently like argue and think the others are idiots because they use different kinds of adhesive or something. But you know, like, I mean,
they do.
Do they? Because yes, maybe they do in a more civilized way. Maybe it's like these professions have been around long enough that they've come up with ways to, you know, not be so like Hatfield and McCoy, but it seems
all they agree on is that water flows downhill.
Well, it just seems like the one thing that all software developers seem to have in common is that they disagree with other groups of software developers.
I think that's true anytime you put people who are passionate about their craft together, regardless of what that craft is. I don't think that's unique to us.
I do think that, like, whenever, like, and conferences are a great way to make this happen. Like, whenever I talk to other developers in any field at a conference and we actually sit down and talk about something, we have a huge amount in common. It's just online, it does not appear to be that way. You know, I mean, it's just people are, oh, you're in this camp, I'm in this camp. Maybe I just see the negative side of it. But it's like, I do think it would be like getting, you know, say a Java architect and a Ruby architect, or I don't know if there's a Ruby architect or whatever, you know, like getting top developers in the different fields to agree on what they think is important is difficult, because partly that's what defines what these different languages and systems are built around. Like, you know, in a lot of ways, different languages and different development methodologies are built in reaction to other, you know, and in reaction to saying, well, we don't like static typing, like it's a bad idea, so we're moving to this, or, you know, that kind of thing.
John, you're totally wrong.
Wait, did you prove my point?
I kind of take it back even a little bit farther. So I look at the word software craft and I think of craftsmanship. And the word I usually associate with craftsmanship is beauty. So, you know, the traditional kind of craftsman, you can see the beauty in their work. And I haven't ever really seen beautiful code. I mean, I've seen code that other people have said is beautiful. And I look at it and I'm like, yeah, that's words on a screen. That's neat. I see code that is functional. I see code that is easy to read. But I don't see code that would inspire me to write other code like you would. You know, if you see a crafted chair or house or hear a beautiful piece of music, you know, it would inspire you to better yourself. Whereas when you see code, you just kind of think, hey, looks like I wouldn't have to gouge my eyes out if I had to work on that. So can we, maybe what I'm trying to ask here is software development really a craft, or are we just trying to lift ourselves up as an ego stroking practice?
I think you got a couple of things tied up in there, but I am stunned that you can't go look at some really beautifully expressed code and be inspired by it. I never would have thought that.
Yeah, trust me. I've looked at lots and lots of different code, you know, from typing in assembly code back in the Commodore 64 days to Smalltalk to experimenting with JavaScript itself. And it doesn't make me go, Wow, that's so elegant.
Are you a visual thinker?
Probably not.
He's an olfactory thinker.
Yeah, it's got to stink for me to really get into it.
I'll bet you're not. And the reason I think that is because when I think about code, if I'm laying in bed thinking about code, I don't see text. I see shapes. I see blocks and objects to move around. And that's how I see code in my mind. And so there's definitely an elegance and beauty to be achieved there. And if I were just thinking about code the way it actually appears on a screen without that sort of visual metaphor in my head, yeah, that wouldn't be very interesting.
Maybe it's because my primary background is in hard sciences and in music. And so I look at, you know, music makes, you know, causes physical reactions in me. Like when I hear the intro to Crazy Train by Ozzy Osbourne, not the redone versions, but the actual Randy Rhoads one, I'll get goosebumps. And I think anyone who really appreciates, you know, good guitar playing will hear that and kind of have some kind of reaction to hearing it. And I know I can break it down into chord progressions and notes, but for me, kind of the feeling and the groove that he gets from it, kind of like a really good jazz improvisation, is more than the sum of the parts. Whereas I don't get that from code.
Code is the parts. The sum of the parts is the running application. That's where the type of impactful beauty you're talking about lives, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking that as Scott was saying that, like I mean, I see code as a means to an end, and you want it to be good and clean, but it serves a purpose. Like code just for the sake of code is computer science or something. It's not software craftsmanship. Like,
maybe that's it. The nail isn't beautiful, but the shelf that it makes is.
Right, the cathedral.
Yeah, so we're just back to that, aren't we?
I guess so. Well, I guess that's the show. Done.
None of that was particularly interesting.
All right, this is where the MC jumps in and puts things back in line. Well, that's me. So... yeah, go ahead, John.
Well, I'm just curious how this ties back into, not just this, but the broader discussion ties into where David's going in his future work, if he can talk about that, like how, you know, how we apply what we're talking about to, you know, building tools and ALM software and, you know.
To Visual Studio Team Foundation System Enabler .NET version 12. Yeah.
Well, if you're just going to insult me. Look, here's the thing. There are a lot of people out there who don't have podcasts, who don't, go to conferences every other week, who don't live this profession the same way I know you guys do, in the way I do, that still do really great work, and they work in bigger companies, and they deserve some love too. And not only that, but what can we learn from people who are out there on the bleeding edge, turn that into pragmatic tools that can be accepted and used to help the lives of enterprise developers? I think that's a pretty good endeavor. So that's one of the reasons, one of the big reasons I wanted to go and make this change, going to Microsoft. And if I can continue to respect the hierarchy, you know, the hierarchy of people over process and process over tools, then I think it's really great to make tools.
But I don't want to harp on you, because I know you're a good guy, and I know Peter is a super good guy, and most of the stuff that is in Visual Studio 2012, like the fakes and all that, is because Peter was like banging the gong.
That's true. That's very true.
But most of the time, when people think of Microsoft source control ALM tooling, and they think of going to work there, they think in terms of making it suck less.
Okay. So what do you think could be done to change that?
Make it suck less.
Okay. No.
And that's a good point. Most of the time that people have an issue that I've heard and that I've experienced, they have a problem with the source control mechanism, and they usually caveat it and say, oh, but the process management stuff is great. And I didn't find the process management inspiring either. I haven't found anything outside of sticky notes on a whiteboard really inspiring, but that's...
I like Asana these days.
I'm an edge case and I'm a weirdo, so I'm okay with that. But I guess I would say, what would you say were the major stumbling blocks that you hope you can address in Microsoft tooling where you'll have the most influence, wherever that's going to be when you find out what the job is?
Wow. There is no way to answer that.
And yet answer it you must.
And yet answer it I will.
I'll just beep out whatever you say so you can just talk, you know.
Then when you find out what you're actually doing, we'll dub it back in.
I would like to see development teams treated as a team of people developing software and delivering it together rather than focus along these roles of coder, UX expert, architect, database expert, all that stuff. So I know that you guys have probably heard the terms specializing generalist. I strongly prefer that too. I want to help make some tools that help change those cultures in the teams where they're so used to throwing things over the wall and blaming each other. If we can help people understand a different way of working together by giving them different tools, then great. I think that's a win. And I think that can make a difference in some people's lives.
You know, I just have to say, like, that does make a lot of sense. And talking about, you know, even so, I've been to a lot of conferences this summer and talked to a lot of people. And, you know, even among people that go to conferences, which puts them in this very top percentile of people who really, like, care or, you know, are out there, you know, trying to better themselves and their craft and all that. You know, when I talk casually to people, they'll say, hey, I'm working with, you know, this legacy system, or I'm, you know, my company is still running on this or whatever. And it's, you know, like, bettering tools has a direct impact, not just on, you know, I mean, it has an impact on a lot of people.
It really does. There's this weirdness that we can identify. We talked about people over process over tools as a value system. Okay, so that's a value system that we can all probably stand back and look at and go, yeah, I like that. I think that that's true. That's the way things should work. Well, they don't. The way things really work is that the tool sets the rules.
Mm.
That's really what happens out there. And so if we can just admit that in fact the tool sets the rules and that's counter to our value system, then what we should do is build tools that promote a better value system. So in other words, build tools that encourage and guide people to work in cleaner, better ways. And I think executable specification is a perfect example of that. How do you know when the feature is done? That little light turns green. That's a pretty powerful metaphor.
Or you have managed to fool the little light into turning green.
Well, if you do that, you're fireable, because that means you're a scumbag.
And if you can hook into Microsoft CRM, right? I mean, there's probably some hooks, and you can actually fire the person directly from the ALM system. Something to look into, I'm just saying.
Available, awesome. Fireable. Boom.
Yeah, break the build. Just like your computer shuts down, you know, hook in with IT.
In all seriousness, I was able to show on this project recently that the developers had gone in and provided 100% code coverage on this FDA-regulated tool that they were making.
Hmm.
100% code coverage. Oh, you know what, though? They forgot the asserts. That is no joke. That is no joke. So they were able to actually say to their bosses, 100% code coverage. And wow. They weren't actually doing any asserts in their tests, which means that their tests were worthless.
We don't need a code of ethics.
Exactly. That is a fireable offense in my mind. Seriously, that's just lying to people.
Wow.
Wow.
That's crazy.
So, yet true.
Say, we had a couple questions come in on Twitter. Jeff Schumacher wants to know if you still have the awesome fire shoes.
Why, yes. Yes, I do.
I've seen those shoes. We'll have to dig up a picture somewhere and make sure we link to them in the show notes.
We can do that. They're Doc Martens with an applique of orange leather flame.
That's awesome.
There were a lot of years where I would only speak in public wearing those shoes, but then I started traveling more, and they're big, and they take up room in the suitcase, so I quit.
All right, another question. This is the code junkie. Why should someone choose TFS over the other options when doing Agile/Scrumish?
They shouldn't. They should choose. You should separate those questions and say, how are we going to do business together? Agile, Scrumish, whatever. Great. And then ask the question, what tooling supports the way we want to work? And if TFS happens to be that, then great.
Mm.
If it's not, do something else.
Brian Lagunas wants to know about the downsides of TDD and how to overcome them. What are the downsides?
There are no downsides if you don't put those asserts in there, right?
Well, in Brian's world, I happen to know that he lives in the world of CSLA, and he thinks that that's single responsibility and all of the things that we make fun of Rocky for. And he just thinks that us unit testing hippies are a bunch of weirdos. And he's a friend of mine, too, by the way. So it's perfectly okay. We have this debate all the time. But Brian's just not a fan and doesn't see why he should do anything that doesn't start with XAML. Right, buddy? What?
Can you write your tests in XAML? Maybe that bridges that.
XAML spec.
Yeah, you could, because XAML is just a serialization, right? I'm starting on it now.
Let's not even joke about this.
Please, please don't give me any ideas.
I'm going to code right now, getting that name.
Test the animations without ever having to write non-declarative code. XAML spec.
Going to reserve that one.
So, Scott, in reference to your other question, I am indeed still rocking the Gibson. The Gibson, as of course, is the particular grooming style that I have, as do many other middle-aged fat American men. And that is the full goatee with the shaved bald head. That, of course, is the Gibson. You know, if the mullet can have a name, so can this look, because I think we've come around. So it's the Gibson. The variations on the Gibson are many. So, for example, Mr. Galloway is sporting the raw Gib.
The raw Gib.
Yeah, that's no facial hair.
Okay.
Don't ask him what the full Gib is.
Well, and then you got the half Gib, right? And the half Gib is when you've got the lower part of the goatee, but not the upper part.
Mm.
You know, those guys always look like they should be in a ring fighting each other.
That's not the Lincoln Gib?
The what?
The Lincoln Gib?
Lincoln Gib, that's what it should be. That's better.
Amish Gib? Right. I don't know.
So Gib variations, but I'm rocking the full Gibson, baby.
Awesome.
So we had another question from Twitter from Paul Stack, and he asked if Scrum's become a make-believe methodologies companies say they're using to prove they're agile.
I think that Scrum can't do anything. It's just a set of rules on a piece of paper, really. But are companies out there absolutely bastardizing what it means to be agile and bastardizing what it means to use a tool like Scrum or XP or Lean or Kanban? Sure, they do it all the time. And they've been doing it for as long as humans have been around. And this is not new to software development. And if you think back to the 90s, we saw some fads in business. Things like total quality management, TQM. Things like cross-matrix management models for big companies. And they make a run through that. And some companies succeed with it and some don't. I think that's definitely the case with Scrum. It's one of those tools that some companies are going to be successful with, some aren't. But because of that statistic we quoted earlier, that it's so darn popular, everybody wants to say they're doing it. And one thing I've become fond of telling people is, look, if you're going to try this, just do this. Try it by the book for 3 months or so before you think you know better and you're different, because you're not. I've been in enough of these companies now to know that you're not. So just try it by the book for 3 months. And what that means, unfortunately for you, is that you must read the book. And if you do that, then I think you have a much better chance of not having this just become another silly little management fad in your company. If, however, you treat it like most companies do, which is, I read some stuff on a blog and it seems like this is a good idea and we could call ourselves agile, then yeah, I think that's exactly what some companies are doing.
You know, that's a good thing you point out there is that, I mean, you talk to so many companies and every company believes that they're different and they need to be different for whatever reason. And it's almost all like it's pretty much never a good idea. Like, I mean, most of the reasons why it's like, well, we can't really do the right thing because we're different, because, and then there's no really good reason to it, you know? And it's like, maybe it's better to not be different. You know, I mean, if other people are doing something successful, maybe work on not being so different.
Yeah, one of the things I like to ask about is simply, why am I here? You know, if an organization has spent the money to bring me in and talk to their teams about how we might do things differently, do the teams themselves realize that, or am I just a pain in their butt, right? So if I show up and they're not really into this discussion, I'll ask, why am I here? And if the answer is because we need to get some of that agile in a box, I'll leave. If the answer is because our life sucks and we want it to be better around here, now we've got something to work with.
Well, usually what I've found at different companies is that it's not so much that they refuse to practice Scrum, but they think or agile methodologies, but they either associate the tooling with the methodology, or they associate the steps of the methodology with agile, when the two are kind of separate. So you read the Agile Manifesto and you see what they're saying there and you say, yeah, I can get behind that. And then you see how it's applied with, like, you know, Rally software, and you go, what the hell is this? This is not people over processes. This is all process. And so you get into what many have called Scrum Butt. Yeah, we do Scrum, but we don't do stand-ups every day. Yeah, we do Scrum Butt.
So that particular one, you went and touched it. You touched my Scrum Butt. So that particular term is something that Ken and I have gone round and round about over the last year. And I try really hard not to say Scrum Butt. And the reason is because you say that word and people automatically look at their feet, because nobody does it by the book. Nobody does it exactly perfect. And to pretend otherwise, I think, is disingenuous. The real truth is we're all trying to just do better. And if we can do things quicker, so we release faster, we do it in increments, and then finally we move maybe to a feature flow model. These are all ways to become more agile. And whether or not you're doing perfect Scrum, whether or not you're using perfect Kanban, is not unlike asking, are you using Visual Studio perfectly? It's just a tool. Are you getting out of it what you need? And if the answer is yes, then why are we sitting here, you know, debating the finer points of it? I think that all of these are just tools to help us become and realize agility.
Good point.
The Scrum Butt thing, it's a recipe for making people feel bad for trying. So quit doing that.
Go, Kevin.
So one of the issues I saw previously with Scrum was, you know, it's really a project management methodology, as opposed to something like extreme, you know, the XP folks, which is more includes engineering practices, you know, as part of the quote unquote definition of the methodology. And I'm curious as to whether you think those things can be separated. Can you successfully do Scrum without some of the other, you know, development practices that go along with agile approaches like TDD or, you know, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I heard you ask two different questions there. One is, can they be separated? Yep. Two is, can you be successful in Scrum without them? Nope. So if we go back to that, you know, can you be successful developing software using Scrum without the XP practices specifically? Well, maybe. Without good standardized technical practices across your team? No, you need those things. You need to have good people and with good skills in order to be successful. Scrum's not hard. Software development is. So can I be successful building software? And now I'm going to take off the with Scrum and just put in with anything else without doing the right thing in building the software. No, you have to be good at building software. So you're absolutely right that Scrum is nothing but a work management model. That's what it is. As is Kanban, right? These are just ways to organize things that don't even exist, our impressions of what work we will be doing in the future. It's just ways to organize that stuff so that we can think about it more clearly. And that's probably enough.
Always comes back to people, doesn't it?
In every case.
I've often wondered if we should think more about how to build teams and how to figure out personalities and things like that. And
one of the coolest things, I got to see some really cool things over the last year working with various companies who called Scrum.org and said, help me. And one of the coolest things I got to do is stand in a room with well over 100 people. And we took these big pieces of paper and we wrote on them the products that the company was going to be producing over the course of the next year. Products. Did not call them projects. So we post these things on the wall around this giant room, and then there's a little bit over 100 people in their IT department came in and they would go stand next to the thing they wanted to work on. That's how we organized that company. And there was some jostling around and moving from here to here to deal with things like specialty of, you know, some sort of skill specialties. But in general, it really worked because people gravitated not just to the people they wanted to work with, but also to the problem domains they found compelling and interesting. And when you do that, you're going to have yourself a passionate team. It's really kind of cool. So one of the neatest things I got to see all year is an entire IT company self-organize into functional teams. And it worked.
That's pretty cool.
I like that from Scott Kuhn. Kanban is a mystical formula that causes unicorns to give rise to fields of magical poppies that cause euphoria.
I think it can get you funded, too. I'm not sure.
It's not just another methodology, sir.
It's not, eh? I actually agree with that. It is a way to improve whatever you're already doing.
Anything you got coming up soon? Like, are you going to be making any public appearances at conferences or user groups or anything like that?
He's going to be appearing at a rest stop on I-5.
That's true.
The next week.
Well, fear came to my eye last night, man. I went to my local .NET user group and did the last talk I'll do for them probably ever. And we looked at all of the bits that dropped this last week, looking at Windows 8 and Visual Studio and TFS Preview, looked at all those things last night. But it was just really cool because I've been going to this user group for 15 years. Wow. You know, and some of the guys in that room last night were there the first night I walked in, and we've all sort of evolved together over the years. And it's been just a great way to be a part of a community. So I strongly advise people to go out and get in their user groups. That's a awesome thing. It really has led me to where I am today.
So it's either a cautionary tale or a path to wellness.
Fair enough. One of the things that I'm trying to do actually is stop traveling so much. So I'm actually really looking forward to doing some things for Microsoft, but not as many as I was doing as an independent guy or for Scrum.org. So I will be at the Patterns and Practices Summit. I'll be at the ALM Summit, things like that that are happening on Microsoft campus. But I'm probably not going to be traveling very much in the next year.
Mm. So is there any remaining questions from this group or from Twitter or anything specifically that you want to address or talk about or let people know about?
Well, I would just like to thank you guys for letting me be the guest on the most navel-gazing episode of Herding Code ever.
That's saying something.
That's a bold statement.
Wait. I think I've done a lot of navel-gazing on the show. I think you missed the one with Bellware where we talked about what HTML really is, or CSS, I think.
Well, this is what happens when I have absolutely no plan. Pretty clear. I probably should have, I don't know, talked with Scott and had a plan.
No.
John has magical editing power, so he'll put this all together. It'll be just like a prepared speech.
It'll be like 8 minutes long, too.
This is how we do things around here. You can't just come in and change things with your agile methodologies.
Fix it in post. That's our motto.
The best idea to come out of today was that.
Get her done.
Yep. Sometimes we throw the first one away and try it again.
Agile.
Yep. Somebody needs to really capitalize on this XAML spec opportunity. I think that's probably the best thing to come out of the show today.
I'm thinking it'll make a great framework to release on April 1st, 2013.
That's not a bad idea at all.
It'll run in the cloud and everything.